This episode of the Belong Podcast is brought to you by Double Hill Cidery, award-winning craft cider made exclusively from wild apples on Prince Edward Island. It's super fresh and crisp and actually tastes like apples. Check out doublehillcidery.com. For most of my adult life, I stayed up to watch the news with Peter Mansbridge on CBC's The National. And it wasn't just his perfectly toned voice delivering us the news of the day or his interviews with the great leaders of the world. Peter was without a doubt the trusted voice of Canada. So what does a guy like Peter do when that gig comes to an end, and how does he make the transition? And how does he stay engaged with that world that he was so used to being connected with every day? Well, let's ask him.
Well, hi, Peter Mansbridge. Welcome to the Belong Podcast.
Hey, Cynthia. It's good to be here.
I really appreciate you taking the time to do this and have a chat today. And I realize that we're both in Stratford.
Yeah, isn't that something? Stratford, yeah. PEI and Stratford, Ontario.
Yeah. Well, there's some synchronicity happening already today. And it's sunny here. What about there?
It's not sunny here.
Okay.
We brought some sun. In fact, it snowed this morning. And it was, it's been a crazy early May weather, but it kind of fits with everything else that's been going on. It's a crazy time.
Oh, isn't it though? It's been enlightening to hear your voice when I tune into the podcast called The Bridge, and hear your news of the COVID pandemic and all the updates and issues that you bring to it. And it's been great to have it. But I want to talk to you about your time. I guess on July 1st of this year, it's going to be 3 years since you stepped down from being anchor on the National.
That's correct. 3 years in Canada Day. Yeah. It's been an exciting 3 years, I got to say. I mean, it's not like I've been sitting on the porch in a rocking chair. I've been pretty busy doing documentaries, giving speeches, in different parts of the country and the continent for that matter. Mm-hmm. Although not too many speeches right now.
No.
And then starting the podcast. So it's all been fun.
Yeah. So when did you start the podcast?
I started it. A lot of people were asking me to do a podcast. And so I wasn't really into it until the election came along last year. And I decided to do a daily podcast just for the election. So I did it for whatever that was, 35 days. And when it was over, I kind of wrapped it up. And then people said, we really enjoyed it. And can't you keep doing it? And maybe once a week. Mm-hmm. So that's what I did until COVID-19 struck. And I decided, you know what, I'm going to go back daily for a while. And that was... I was 8 weeks ago now, so it's
wow.
I'm not sure how long I'm going to keep doing it, but I'll keep doing it for a little while yet.
That's a huge commitment to do something daily like that. I guess you're used to that for 30 years.
Exactly. 30 years of a nightly program. Monday to Friday, anyway, gets you in that kind of rhythm, and so that's what I've been doing. I try to keep it, fairly. Light's not the right word, but it's never scripted. It's very informal, and I just sort of blather away at things that are kind of on my mind each day.
Well, I wouldn't call it blather, but I'm curious to know what it's like though to go from being that public figure, in that you were in everyone's home every night, and that it's not so much like that anymore, albeit that you're quite busy. Was there much of a transition for you to go through from where you are now from the National?
You know, it's funny because I assumed it was going to be difficult and would be hard once I stepped down after, basically 50 years with the CBC, because I was a reporter for 20 years. Before I started anchoring, and I was traveled the country, traveled the world, did a lot of exciting things, met a lot of exciting people, and then suddenly to bang, cut it off.
Yeah,
like that. I thought this is going to be difficult, but quite frankly, after the first week was kind of tough, because you know, for all those reasons. But after that, I kind of got into the rhythm of, you know, not worrying about things every, you know, a few minutes, worrying about what we were going to put on the program. And so it wasn't as hard as I thought it was going to be. And, you know, I've enjoyed it. I found a lot of excitement in doing documentaries. My deal with the CBC is that they still want me around in some form. So, you know, occasionally they have me on as a guest on different programs, but the main thing is to do 2 1-hour documentaries a year. And, you know, as somebody who'd mainly been in the kind of 2-minute world of news items, to get the luxury of an hour to deal with one subject has been, very A, different, but B, really quite rewarding. And so that's taken up a fair amount of my time. I probably spend, 12 to 16 weeks a year on the documentary front. And that still keeps me connected, obviously, with broadcasting and journalism. Although I try not to go in the building very often in the CBC, kind of deliberately. One, you know, I don't want to be that guy who still sort of hangs around after he's left. But also, you know, it affords me that opportunity of some distance away from the daily grind. So it's, you know, it's been very different, but at the same time, the connection is still there.
Oh, that's great. Do you find doing the documentaries more freeing, would you say, than, you do talk about you get a whole hour as opposed to the little 2-minute bits. Does it feel a little more freeing though, as far as what you create at the end of the day?
Well, it does. I mean, there's a luxury to that time, having that time afforded to you to put something together. If you're, you know, spending 6 or 8 weeks on one project, there's often a lot of travel involved to different parts of the world. Before I did a lot of traveling, obviously, when I was doing the National, but every night you had to be somewhere where you could be here. Here you can actually enjoy having a dinner in some exotic place parts of the world. Although, you know, not much of that going on right at this moment. I'm kind of deep into the research element of both the documentaries that I've got planned for this year, but because there's restrictions on travel, we can't actually shoot these yet. But we've got it figured out that hopefully we'll get these done later this year.
Can you say what they're about yet?
Well, in very general ways, we are dealing with the virus on one hand. It's more of as opposed to being caught up in the moment, it's more about, you know, the search for a vaccine. And there are a lot of different angles to that story, some of which are Canadian. The other is in the Arctic, which is, has been a passion of mine for 50 years. I mean, I started working in Canada's North for the CBC, so I've had a passion about the Arctic for a long time, and this one is connected to climate change and the Arctic. So it too involves travel, but I'm still hoping that both of these will happen this year.
Oh, they sound great. Your topics or your choices for producing documentaries, do you find that you tend to kind of think of them more as informative and something that kind of serves a passion of yours?
Both, really. I get to choose what I want. I have to sell the idea to the CBC, to the people who are responsible for airing documentaries. But it's not like they come to me and say, hey, you should do this. Right. I go to them and say, hey, I want to do this. And if they go for it and are willing to put up the money for it, because documentaries aren't cheap, then away we go. So that, I was in the middle of one earlier this year when this virus struck, and we've had to shelve it. It'll I'm sure I'll still do it, but it'll be probably 2-3 years down the road, because it's just not going to fit in with kind of today's stories and the possibilities that exist for this moment.
Mm. One of the things I really enjoy about your podcast is, as I just asked about, you know, is it free, you know, is it more freeing to do a documentary style or documentaries? Your podcast feels, you know, and it is unscripted, but it does feel nice and casual and very accessible. And I love Fridays when you read the letters and connect with people. Did you feel that same kind of sense of connection when you were anchoring with people? Because, I mean, everyone knew who you were. I suppose and imagine that you could hardly go anywhere without someone stopping you. But your podcast feels like a different kind of connection. Is that the way it is for you?
I think it is more personal, and the mail I get. I mean, what you hear on Fridays are usually the main content of the letters. What I don't read are all the nice things they say, right. You know, about me and about the sort of connection they've had with me. Many of these people listened to me when I was when they were young, you know, quite young. Their parents would be listening, and so they sort of listen in at the same time. And so they feel they've been connected to me for a long time, and they feel, you know, and I'm sure this goes with other broadcasters of that era too, that they feel at this time in particular that it's comforting to hear someone who's been a part of their life, right? And so I get a lot of mail like that. When I was doing the program, you would occasionally get mail like that. I would often be stopped by people, like when I, you know, crisscrossing the country in airports and hotels or wherever I might be, with some kind of similar stories. A lot from new Canadians, many of whom came to Canada couldn't speak English, and they learned English by listening to the news. And, you know, I'm people who listen to my podcast will know that I have my delivery is not rapid speed.
No.
I like to take my
time. I'm not saying that, but, you know.
Yeah. I like taking my time reading. And I can remember, you know, the average reading speed is 150 words a minute.
Right.
And at the CBC, I used to read between like 135, 140. And mm-hmm. You know, they'd say, you know, can you speed it up? And I'd say, you know, actually, no, this is the way I talk. Well, it's much slower than that in the podcast because I'm not reading, for one. And, you know, it's sort of coming off the top of my head. And occasionally I want to think through what I'm about to say, which is usually a good idea at times. Anyway, new Canadians would say, you afforded me the opportunity to listen to words carefully. And that's how I started to learn English. And when people say that to you, it's really quite endearing, right? I mean, it's great to hear. And I still get that today from people who remember that's how they learned English. So there was a, you know, it was always a connection at some level with the, you know, with the viewer. But the program was much more intense, right? I mean, you were dealing with that day's news and it was tightly scripted and you only had X number of minutes and seconds to do things. And so there was much more pressure on you than when you do a podcast, when you just sort of go for it. And you know, if you go for 15 minutes, great. If you go for 35 minutes, that's okay too.
Doesn't matter.
Yeah. Nobody holding added, there on you.
Exactly. The added pressure of being Canada's English tutor as well.
Yeah, that's right.
That does add an element. And it's good that people are still engaged that way with your podcast because they definitely have more time to listen to the words. I agree. mm-hmm. for sure. But I love it because it is endearing in that it's like, I think if you've ever listened to Jan Arden on the various ways she communicates with people,
right?
She's just being herself. She's just in her living room. She's talking just as if you were sitting right in front of her. And that's the same kind of feeling that I think people get when they listen to the podcast, is that you could be just right there next to them. And that is very comforting.
Well, it's certainly what you're trying to do, right?
Yeah.
And I mean, you know that as well as I do. You're just trying to be yourself. Let them know what you're thinking and why you're thinking that, and ask, you know, for their help,
exactly
interpreting things. I get quite a bit of mail, so much so that you're quite right that every Friday I just turn that into kind of their thoughts and their questions, and just go with it. And what I've found about podcasts, more so than perhaps the nightly news, is while the listeners or viewers or whatever you want to call them are, it's much smaller with a podcast than obviously it was with the network newscast. But those who take the time to write are really thoughtful. You know, they have a lot of interesting ideas. Whereas with the nightly news, you often get the hotheads, right? And some of them, you know, it's difficult to read and put up with. But I don't think I've ever had a bad, a bad letter.
And oh, good.
Bad meaning, sort of a trashy thing. They've all been thoughtful and with interesting ideas. Like, I'm running a thing this week where I'm asking people to give me their kind of big idea that, you know, as awful as COVID-19 is, and it is awful, it does afford us an opportunity to, when this finally ends, is to kind of remake our society, remake our country or a province, our town, whatever it may be, at least with some new thinking in any number of different areas. And one is in big projects. You know, when you look at, we're in serious economic slump here. I don't need to tell anybody that. And to get out of it, we're going to need some new thinking. And when you go back and you look at the Depression era in the 30s, what got us out of that before the war really got us out, but what got us out was big ideas, big projects.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm asking people, like, if there was a big project out there that you would like to champion, what would it be? You know,
right.
It could be in your town or your province, but certainly within your country. And I mean big projects, like things that cost billions of dollars. After all, that's what our governments are spending. So let's put it to use in a way that, you know, perhaps we're not thinking about right now, that would engage and employ lots of people. And already, I just, you know, suggested this a few days ago, and already I've had lots of big ideas coming in, and they're all interesting, they're all thoughtful, they're all, you know, some perhaps aren't realistic, but they're all good ideas to talk about.
Yeah, and I think too, with because of COVID and the ways that we have had to adjust in order to try and tamp this down and flatten the curve, so to speak, some of the real golden nuggets come out of that. You know, like, is there a way, for instance, that we revamp the education system because now we're trying to figure out how to teach kids from home?
Yep.
Is everyone's working from home? Well, not everyone, but, you know, why is it that we continue to go to the bricks and mortar to work? And we can't, you know, change what we've already done with regards to making those bricks and mortars a reality, but we can certainly find other ways and more productive ways for people to work perhaps from home.
Sure. You know, I mentioned this one day on the podcast, but I was talking to a car dealer, a big car dealer in Winnipeg, a month or so ago, And I asked, because he was still open, they allowed car dealerships there to be open. And I said, what are you learning from all this? And he says, well, I'm learning that I don't need to have my accounting department and my marketing department on site.
Mm-hmm.
They're working just as hard and contributing just as much from home as they ever did here. And so it's got me thinking about all this office space I have and why whether I actually need it, you know, and what could be a better way if they're keen to operate this way as well.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think that kind of thinking is happening in a lot of places and a lot of work areas about what could be different and whether it makes sense to be considering those kind of differences now.
Yeah. And I think also that, you know, I'm assuming governments are paying attention. They're very engaged in this. You know, what will, you know, how will that transpire when it comes to how government operates too? I mean, right now, say for instance, on PEI, the legislature is not in the building sitting. There's lots of communication going back and forth. People are still putting out their press releases and all of that is still happening. There's probably a little more of that happening because they don't have question period. But I noticed, you know, the official opposition here wanting to have question period anyway. You know, I don't know who they're asking the questions to and hopefully government will answer to it. But, you know, it's just a one example of some creativity trying to come to the surface and maybe, you know, have a more productive effect on the future and how they're going to move forward. And I hope you get lots of great ideas on the podcast because I imagine and I hope that whatever it is we all decide are these great ideas that governments are as willing to embrace them as we are.
No, I agree. I think it's a, you know, the temptation is always to say when you hit some kind of major situation like this, although we've never experienced something like this before, but when you think back to 9/11 or the 08 financial crisis or any number of different things, the temptation is to say things will never be the same again.
Right.
And you hear that a lot now. Mm-hmm. And the fact is, we don't know what they're going to be like. And often in the past, when we've said that, well, you know what? They did pretty much end up being the same again. This one does feel different, but we're not going to know. We're not going to know for 2 or 3 years if, you know, a vaccine comes along and suddenly everything goes back to the way it kind of was. We'll all be saying, well, you know, I guess it's not going to really be that different. But I don't know. There's something about this one that is so different than all the other things that certainly I've experienced in my life. Those who are still alive who went through the Second World War, and there's not many of them, talk about how that changed everything for them. And I remember my parents, when they were alive, talking in that way, but not in this way. You know, this is like
right.
But we'll see. You know, the temptation is always to predict the future, and you know, we usually get it wrong.
Yeah. Oh, for some reason, my mind went to America, but we don't have to get into that. Things are pretty nasty down there right now.
It's one of those times when, you know, listen, we love our American neighbors. We love our friends. Mm. And they've been great for us and we've been great for them.
Mm-hmm.
But this is one of those times where certainly for me, I'm proud to say that we're Canadian and we're different.
Yeah, but we get to say that and it's absolutely true.
Yeah.
Thank goodness. Since I started this podcast, I kind of automatically feel just a little bit more hip because, you know, as I mentioned earlier, there's just so much podcasting going on and it just seems like, you know, more and more people are picking up on the idea of doing it, even though podcasting has been around for quite a long time. And it's just not enough to be on Twitter and Facebook and Instagram and all the other things anymore. And it really is, I'm sure, as even, you know, your time on the National, noticing how things are pivoting to more of a self-curated and controlled media that we get to control ourselves, all the social media and the channels and podcasts and everything. In all of that, and you're now in embracing it full on, what do you think about the future of the traditional media in that, and how it will either change or is changing? And do you have some ideas about how that looks like into the future?
You know, we are at a sort of a crossroads in the relationship between the kind of general public and the traditional media. And so much of it is based around one word, and that's trust.
Mm-hmm.
If you're trusted, you're always going to have an audience. If there is some doubt poked in that word, then you got to earn it back. And right now, I think there is a lot of question marks around the relationship between the public and the media, the traditional media.
Mm-hmm.
Part of it is based on the fact the traditional media has been under attack by new media, has been for 10 or 15 years, at least. We watch print in trouble. We watch newspapers all the time going under. And still, even right now, when there's a desperate need for information, you're seeing newspapers going under. You're seeing television audiences drop considerably, as they have in the last couple of years, as people who still use television use it for different reasons, you know, and through this whole thing. I mean, just look at the numbers and the way they've skyrocketed for, you know, streaming services like Netflix and Disney and Prime and all these different options that people use now, and they, you know, cutting their cords to cable companies, they're getting away out of traditional television services. Radio's still pretty strong. Television has got to find a way to adapt, but it all comes down to trust. And when you get, you know, somebody like Trump who throws, you know, condemnations of journalism in general out all the time, and some people bite on it and believe it, and some news organizations feed into it by having questionable journalism on their hand. But if you're going to survive in this era, you've got to build that trust factor back up again. I mean, you're a former politician. Maybe you're still a politician. I don't know. But when you look at the sort of the every year they do surveys about trust and in terms of who has it and who doesn't have it and who's losing it, and always at the top of the list, and historically they've been at the top of the list, there's kind of like nurses and doctors and firefighters, first responders. Those are always at the top. It used to be that journalists weren't too far behind, and politicians were sort of at the halfway mark. And down at the bottom were, you know, used car salesmen.
Yeah.
But now, who's at the bottom? Politicians are at the bottom.
Yeah.
And journalists aren't that much further ahead.
Yeah.
And that's not good for democracy in either case, right?
No.
Politicians deserve some of the knocks they've had on them. They don't deserve to be in last place in trust surveys.
That's no, I agree.
Sense. Yeah. And neither do journalists. But the journalism field has become so broad and so wide and so many different sources of news. I mean, I teach the odd class at the University of Toronto at the Monk School. And I did a survey with a class I guess it was last year. There were about 100 graduate students there. And I asked them to raise their hands on a number of different points, because I was looking for, where do you get, what's your primary source of news? Okay. Mm. And I started off with, okay, print. Well, you know, hardly anybody in the room raised it. But I was shocked to see that not a lot more raised their hand for television.
Right.
More raised their hands for radio. Mm-hmm. Podcasts, a considerable number of kids did raise mm-hmm. their hand for podcasts.
Yeah.
And a disturbing number raised their hand on the internet.
Right.
And that's okay if you're using the internet to either watch or read or listen to, you know, the BBC or the New York Times or the Washington Post or the Globe and Mail or the CBC or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Those kind of mainstream, traditional, respected,
trustworthy,
exactly, mm-hmm. organizations. Not so much if you're going, oh, well, I read it on Facebook and I don't know where it came from. Maybe it came from the BBC. Maybe it didn't. But to me, it was Facebook. Mm-hmm. Well, that's not good enough.
No.
And that's not going to lead to an informed.
No, it's not.
Educated, thoughtful public. No. And a good democracy. It doesn't work.
No, I mean, it engages people, but it doesn't necessarily invoke what you're, you know, that word trust. It just right. doesn't. I think initially the idea of social media and all the different platforms it involved, I really do believe that the idea was to actually be more democratic. But I really also think that it's out of control. I don't know if there's any control really that anyone can try and place on it that's going to give it that feeling that I can trust what I read or see. It certainly can be entertaining, but and I can use it for that. But if I'm going there to look for information that I can trust, it's probably not a great place to start.
No, you know, it's not. And the, you know, the original idea of it being a more, pond of democracy, it, you know, still holds some value and some truth. But it's also this pit that's a sewer in so many other ways. And ensuring that you understand the distinction between those two will determine how useful a tool it is for you to be a good citizen of a world that demands great citizenship, especially right now.
Yeah. Hopefully that's something that's on the curriculums in school, is trying to decipher and figure that all out. Cause it's tough for the best of people to try. I mean, I can think of examples of, you know, people I know who should know better, you know, sharing things on their social media accounts. And I think, did you not click on the link and read it, you know?
Right.
Like, take the time and figure this out. Right. You're right. Not helping here.
No.
But anyway, yeah. Peter, listen, I'm really appreciative of the time you took to have this chat today with me. I think that I love that you brought up the word trust, because, you know, in these times that we're experiencing, it's just so difficult for so many people. And having familiar voices like yourself, you know, making their way again into people's rooms. We don't know which room it's in anymore, but it's really helping to try. It's really helpful for people to be able to navigate through this. And I genuinely mean that. It's comforting, as you said earlier. Your voice to Canadians is that. And I think your commitment to what you're doing right now is a good one. And I appreciate it.
Cynthia, it's been a treat talking to you, and it's been a treat knowing that you're in PEI, which is always, you know, I don't say this just to suck up to you, but it has always been one of my favorite places in the country. It's where my Cynthia and I got married in Malpec.
Right, you did.
Back in 1998. And, you know, it's a beautiful province, and I hope somehow this summer that we're able to visit all the places that we love visiting, and that's certainly one of them.
Well, if you're by this way, let me know. I'll put you on a couple of bicycles and take you for a little tour.
Okay. Sounds great.
Take care, Peter. Thanks again.
You too. Bye.
Bye.
Thank you to Peter Mansbridge for spending time with us today. It was fantastic. I trust you enjoyed that as much as I did speaking with him. Have a great week, and I hope you belong right here with us next week.